You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. This is September 9th, 2020, and I'm recording on location in Virginia, somewhere in Virginia. If there's any background noise, I apologize for that. This is a very sensitive microphone, and I am in a hotel room, so you're just going to have to forgive me. Normally, of course, the audio quality is extraordinary. But I thank everyone who has donated to me in the past. You're the only reason that I'm able to stay as independent and as free as I am. But you're probably tired of hearing about that by now. I'm tired of talking about it. So for the next hour, you're going to hear me talk about something I haven't spoken of in a long time. Because I've been bogged down in political things, but that's not what the show was initially about, and I go back and forth on this all the time. Some of you may have heard that E. Michael Jones has a new book out on logos, which is the Greek word for word, with a capital W, not just words as in words on a page, but the structure of thought, and he's one of my favorite authors who I've known for a long time. And it's a book that's typical of him. It's 1,000 pages. I think the introduction is 1,000 pages or something like that. So it's not a beginner's book, but it's one I recommend. I haven't gone through the entire thing yet. The section on Hegel I'm iffy about. But otherwise, it's a great book. Michael's one of those guys who, when I was in grad school, took a... realized I wasn't alone when I started reading him. And not only just I wasn't alone, but there were other academics who had been removed from positions and everything else based on purely philosophical, not even ideological concerns, philosophical concerns. So, Logos and St. Gregory of Nyssa and Gregory the Theologian, two of the major names in the patristic era. And the tragedy is that unless you're Orthodox, you've never heard of them before, although Christianity is largely based on them. The intellectual background of the church, what everyone else takes for granted, comes from people who are completely esoteric not everyone can read these guys. You have to know Plato and Aristotle to read these guys. You have to know what the word logos means, for one thing. But these are some of the men who put the books of the Bible together. The Bible is not the ultimate authority of the church. The church created the Bible. The Bible is just a list of initially 74 books. The Protestants have taken book after book out. Even the Catholics have taken two out. The 72 versus 74. But these are the men who put the intellectual background of the church together that everyone simply takes for granted and doesn't understand. Gregory of Nyssa and Gregory the Theologian are roughly in the same era. But even those writing on the patristic era, the church fathers don't have any background in the history of metaphysics. The combination of both the knowledge of theology and the knowledge of metaphysics sometimes it's relatively rare. So, but those writing on metaphysics don't often see the patristic writings as legitimate continuations of Plato. Or even metaphysical systems at all, even though they're metaphysicians in their own right. Now, the section I'm going to deal with here comes from my book that I've been working on for a very long time, which may never get done, The Ontology of Death, Patristic Philosophy Against Promethean Nominalism, which is supposed to be my magnum opus I've actually dealt with chapters from this book before. These are still relatively rough, but I'm the first to come up with the idea that, well, not come up with the idea, but to explain the idea that nominalism is the root evil. Modernism, liberalism, anything else comes from nominalist ideology. But their opponents, the realists, believe in forms. Most of you know what a form is, form with a capital F. These are archetypes. They're reality with a capital R, reality in a strict sense, which is where the name realist comes from. The problem is because material things are always in flux, not to mention our human perceptions pick up only a tiny little bit of what's out there, there can't be any knowledge based on them. Forms have to exist for there to be any knowledge whatsoever. So the external world is extremely weak. Sense perceptions are very weak. And forms have to exist in order for there to be any knowledge at all. Forms, of course, are, after St. Augustine, in the mind of God, and is what Logos is. They're collected in the second person of the Trinity. But so St. Gregory writes this. He says, this is from his Life of Moses, in chapter 2. He says, none of those things which are apprehended by sense perception and contemplated by the understanding really subsists, but the transcendent essence and cause of the universe on which everything depends alone subsists. For even if the understanding looks upon any of these existing things, reason observes in absolutely none of them the self-sufficiency by which they could exist without participating in true being, that's being with a capital B. On the other hand, that which is always the same, neither increasing nor diminishing, immutable to all change, whether the better or worse, for it's far removed from the inferior and has no superior, standing in need of nothing else, alone desirable, participated in, but all but not lessened by their participation. This is truly real being, and the apprehension of it is knowledge. So, Gregory of Nyssa was more of a poet than a metaphysician, in a strict sense. But he was one of a long line of Greek Platonists who saw Christ inherent, or I should say intimated, in Platonic thinking, especially the realism of Plato and Plotinus. But the use of Neoplatonic metaphysics is to solve Plato's problem, and how the Greeks and the Orthodox world solved the problem, how forms can be brought into the experience in the daily purview of the average person. The average person back then. But when Plato died, that was his greatest problem in his system. If the forms were the source of goodness in nature, then the remoteness from human experience is a gaping hole in the theory. Plato was a prophet, so to speak, in the sense he was given insight into the structure of the world that could only be made complete by Christ's revelation as the I Am. He refers to himself as I Am several times, which of course is a translation of Yahweh. When he told the Jews that he, before Moses was I Am was referring to himself as Yahweh. Most people miss this part, even though he refers to himself as God in that particular statement, and that's why they pick up the rocks to kill him. But Gregory's metaphysics is based on the Symposium. Plato's Symposium, in the sense that all earthly pleasures lead to pleasures that don't fade. If there are specific pleasures, then there's one that is ultimate, a pleasure that's not mixed with pain, which, of course, can only be God himself. Those reading St. Augustine can understand this. All earthly loves imply that love with a capital L, the origin of love's form that unifies and defines all of them. The grace that is God's presence on earth in his church is a manifestation, the hypostasis, so to speak, of the form of beauty and love accessible to men who need only believe in the Trinity and all that it implies. If there is a specific instance of love, then there has to be an ultimate love, or else the word doesn't make any sense. The opposite of a definition is a spectrum, and a spectrum is the only thing that nominalists could ever come up with. But the ascent of the mind from specific things to the most general things, which is central to the patristic vision in general, requires that intellect and the passions be not, well, the passions be transfigured rather than repressed. Now, the ascent is a standard concept in ascetic philosophy, and it just remains the absolute center of everything. The ascent implies that man lives in a nominal world, one populated by individual sensibles or individual things that are not and can never be the object of knowledge, only a provocation. They provoke the passions, not the intellect. But the ascent is to leave that world, the world of physical sensibles, and grow in spirit and mind to apprehend in some limited way the forms themselves, which is another way of saying logos, but in pieces rather than entirely. Now, the word passion gets used a lot. Some people think it means just enthusiasm, but it's far more significant than that. It's a problem only in the sense that it assumes that nominalism is true, that only the physical, individual, sensible is real, that the only things that are real are individual things, which, of course, is nonsense. The sensible thing, the individual thing, doesn't impress the mind in any kind of a rational way, but it does provoke the passions. It demands its acquisition and domination. The object is perceived as a means to an end, as far as bodily pleasure is concerned. It's not a bad thing, necessarily, but it is an incomplete one. The objects that exist imply one that exists internally. Eternally, sorry. We naturally desire delight and satisfaction, but only those things that don't go away. Our limited pleasures necessarily imply much greater. But that's the transfiguration of the mind's power through actual constitution of perceived objects. It forces the earthbound mind upwards to the world of forms, truth with a capital T that doesn't change. If it changes, it isn't truth. But the nominous world of individuals is false. It changes, and more importantly, can never be the essential cause of knowledge. The only thing it could cause is a passionate response. These beings, these things exist as expressions of reason and logic. If logic and reason are things added to the sensible world, like the nominalist has to claim, then there's no a priori reason to assume that this logic is not utterly foreign to the objects of the world. Reason has to be not just internal to us, it also has to be out there. Otherwise, logic is just simply imposed on something totally alien to it. Logic, in the point of view, presupposes that it's a human creation that exists to work on sensible objects and is foreign to them. The Enlightenment, the modern world, is based on that idea, that logic is not inherent in nature outside of us and therefore has to be imposed violently on it. But that which is particular is understood that way because of the organization of social life. Now, I mentioned that I didn't like his section on Hegel so much, although I haven't been through it in any great detail yet. And he doesn't get into the metaphysics of the matter, which is probably a good thing for most of us. But our apprehension of form socially, but the organization of the social world is prior to any speculation about reality. Social life produces a vague consensus that is then imposed on the world of sensation. So modernity, speaking generally, stresses the Cartesian self, which is an arbitrary abstraction from the whole, and the social community is conspicuously left out. If you notice, from Descartes onward, up until Hegel, the social world is completely left out of epistemology. But even the general will of Rousseau is an abstraction without any inherent content. But this is one of the central steps in grasping any kind of rational defense of medieval metaphysical realism. The human consciousness is agency and purpose in the same way that unity of the Trinity is its power. Agency comes first. Will comes first. So someone like Nikolai Berdyaev, his existentialism, God's freedom pre-exists the creation of matter. Will and consciousness are one and the same thing, and in a very real way, exist in potential before being applied to any action. The Trinity is based on the rejection of nominalism, since a nominalist can make no sense out of three persons of an identical a substance at the same time. Nominalist epistemology can't grasp the existence of any kind of universal, the highest universal, generating two additional persons who remain fully persons, while of the same essence. So, the world of the Trinity is a social whole, but it excludes the concept of individualism in favor of the most concrete of all universals, unified by a common purpose and power. The relations of the Trinity are significant as the persons themselves. Relations are just as significant as anything else. Love, a mutual ontology that unifies the persons in their separateness. But that's not entirely foreign to our social life. To separate the individual from the social whole that created them in the first place is arbitrary, and it's factually false. It's logically false. There's no possibility of the individual without the whole. The individual is a product of the whole, whose reason is generated through the socialization and education the social community provides in the first place. In other words, individualism is false because in the process of defending it, you have to use collective logic and language and arguments that you've heard elsewhere. So even in defending individualism, it's immediately rejected. So only through ideological special pleading is the individual, the isolated individual, taken as paramount. So Gregory writes, this is poetic in this sense, his commentary on Ecclesiastes. He says, the universe contains everything, and its harmony does not admit the dissolution of created beings. Instead, we have concord between them all. Neither is the universe severed from many of its parts. Instead, he who truly exists holds all things by his power. God is indeed true existence or absolute goodness. Also, any name we ascribe to him points his unutterable reality. In section 406. So, it's unutterable in the same sense that Spinoza's substance is unutterable. It contains in and of itself infinite content, or as far as we're concerned, infinite content. Logos is a very primal manifestation of infinite content given logical form and structure. This is why the essence of logos can't be understood by the limited human intellect. It assumes familiarity with infinite content, something which is beyond our abilities. While we can grasp the presence of this law and structure in natural and social forms, this is logos only in its limited and very partial manifestation. So St. Gregory in this passage stresses the concept of concord between all forms of the cosmos. Logos serves as the essence, in Aristotle's sense, of objects in the cosmos, including the whole itself, as well as the relations among objects, systems, and subsystems of the whole. The whole, therefore, becomes an object, though not of cognition. This is the partial manifestation of logos presented to us. So Gregory's Platonism is shown by the phrase, does not admit of the dissolution of created beings. The point here is that the forms of objects don't disappear. Their manifestations in the world of sense come and go, but the eternal archetype of logos remains. Power in this passage is used identically as St. Gregory Palamas will explain many years later. The power that holds all the cosmos together as a whole is the light of God. Light meaning energies, grace, power. They're synonymous. All one and the same object. Light is therefore metaphysical. It's a metaphysical concept that refers to the grace of God via logos, sustaining the cosmos as a single thing, as a law-bound entity. You can't have science without law. You can't have science without regularity. You can't have science without logos. You can't have science with nominalism. Hence the notion of industrialization as some alien force imposed on a nature that's not prepared to serve it. But the broader point is that this grace is personal. It's the presence of logos, the second person in the Trinity of God. The structure is not a dead scientific law, but it is a person. He says this on the Psalms. He says, if the entire world order is a kind of musical harmony, whose artisan and creator is God, as the Apostle says, then man is a microcosm, an imitator of him who made the world. The divine plan for the world sees this image in what is small, for the part is indeed the same as the whole. Similarly, a piece of small transparent stone reflects like a mirror the entire sun, in the same way a small object reflects God's light. I say in the microcosm, man's nature, all the music of the universe, it's analogously seen in the whole through the particular, inasmuch as the whole is contained in the particular. The structure of our body's organs follows the same example, for nature has skillfully constructed it to produce music. The difference between the person, the social hold in God, is highly fluid. Now, there's no strict boundaries here. Boundaries exist because human beings are fragile and fallible and limited. The whole is the only object of knowledge. But human beings can only begin from the immediate and relatively false report of the senses. The Trinity remains both the first church and the first society, where individuals find their place only within the whole. They become individuals only in the secondary sense, that the whole and its functions have created them and endued them with the proper moral vision and function at all. The whole creates the part, it's whole with a capital W, creates the part in the sense that the part only makes sense when considered as part of the whole. But the modern world, modernity, is based on destroying the whole, and as a moral result, enthroning the greed of acquisition as the primal, base, and purposeful element of human life. It becomes its own end, in other words. These realizations, or the ancient foundation of realist thinking, both metaphysically and socially. And those two fields, as I've said many times before, are highly integrated and related. And the distorted thinking of modern metaphysicians is based around the complete separation of these various branches of the same reality. Today, the philosophical establishment has much to answer for, with large salaries and light teaching loads unmatched by any real contribution to actual understanding. Now, when I first started writing this, analytical philosophy tried to justify itself as somehow the inferior handmaiden to what they think science is. Serious philosophy is being done only outside of the universities. There can't be any separation between the assumption of nominalist ideas and the analytic desire to serve as a retainer of the scientific elite. But ethics, social life, theology, ontology are the same thing. They use different vocabularies in approaching the identical subject matter, but from different methodological starting points. There's no metaphysics apart from social life, since our associations create metaphysical speculation in the first place. Realism assumes that social communities are the only basis of social life, but nominalism assumes that the individual is. The argument for both is ultimately a social one. The separation of metaphysics from social life is arbitrary, and of course the result of academic bureaucratic thinking rather than actual reality. Now, the social whole and our place in it is set down by the functionality of the Trinity, which is, people don't realize this is not a truly academic matter. The realization of the Trinity doesn't normally come from a fallen universe, although St. Augustine may disagree with this, but it requires personal purification and transformation in order to be seen clearly in its effects, of course, never in its essence. So the incarnation, which is continued, so to speak, by the sacraments, is the bringing to earth of the forms of Plato in their true sense, via logos. The forms now make sense in that they are collected, so to speak, in logos. A sense where the sinful and fallen man can grasp the purpose and structure of the form without having recourse necessarily to abstract philosophy. Plato was metaphysically correct, and his vision went as far as unaided human reason can go. Christ's presence is a means of rectifying normal human error in these central matters. But Plato laid out the foundation, and of course the church filled in the many blanks. But any good realist would realize that logos theology is a presence of the immanent forms in nature. It's not to say that they're not independent forms, that form of divinity present in the church, but human senses see the form as immanent before they see it as transcendent. Nevertheless, even fallen humanity can dimly see the wisdom present in the natural world. Again, that's wisdom with a capital W. To make sense out of this, you have to have proper doctrine. Realism versus nominalism, a debate which was alive in Plato's time, laid the first real debate over the nature of reality. The spiritual world can't be nominal, almost by definition, and that the spirit is by its very structure a form. The spiritual world cannot be sought after in a lustful sense, because it isn't physical in the first place. The centrality of nominalism in modern society is identical with the unleashing of the passions of domination. Nominalism is the source of moral error. And again, St. Gregory says this: even the inquiry as to the thing in the flesh itself, which assumes all the corporeal qualities, has not been pursued to any definite result. For if anyone has made a mental analysis of that which is seen in its component parts, and having stripped the object of its qualities, has attempted to consider it by itself, I fail to see what will be left to investigation. For when you take from a body its color, its shape, its hardness, weight, quantity, position, its forces, active or passive, its relation to other objects, what remains that still can be called a body, we can neither see of ourselves, not taught by it by Scripture. Wherefore also, the elements of this world, we know only so much that our senses are able to receive, but they severally supply us for our living. We possess no knowledge of their substance. And that's from Eunomius. And the purification of the mind, will, and senses is a prelude to being able to experience the grace of the resurrection, to see logos and wisdom clearly in the natural world. And logos and wisdom are synonymous in most cases. The sacramental life is a small glimpse of this, since it is a natural world set aright. The presence of wisdom, logos, and purpose, which are all one thing, become clear, even or especially, to simpler minds, who don't really have access to philosophy in the first place. The nominalist understanding of abstract objects, really abstract qualities, disappears as logos, the immanent form of truth in things, it becomes clearer. Specific qualities, while part of the world's beauty, become radically secondary to their final and formal cause. Qualities are illusions, born of falseness and mental dispersion. Of course, they have a place, but they're radically secondary to the actual truth of the objects they point to. Qualities are symbols in the true sense. They're not objects in and of themselves, but they do point to reality with a capital R. So our knowledge of matter is only the knowledge of individual things, the only things considered to exist in the modern mind. Matter, though, does contain, so to speak, spiritual qualities. It's weight or texture, but albeit quantitative ideas. All matter is, as far as the human mind is concerned, the collection of quality. So in that sense, anomalists are correct, except this is not the end of the story. Skovoroda, for example, writes the mere quality of appearance is the very definition of matter. Getting behind appearance, stripping it away, is the entire purpose of philosophy in the first place. Reality is one of the most unreal elements of the modern mind. Reality is that which does not appear, but generates appearance. It's wisdom in the Old Testament sense. Logos, as the forms present in nature, or rather the form of the good or wisdom, and you can see this in Genesis, where the Logos, or the Word of the Father, becomes manifest in the specific sense of natural objects, or natural systems that generate individuals as secondary elements of themselves. Systems are created, systems that are manifestations of wisdom. Objects might be the most obvious ingredient of the system, but they exist only because the system exists first, the Logos exists first. Creation is self-contained through the presence of wisdom. It is self-regulating and mutually reinforcing, and therefore natural laws, that's the active presence of Logos, is inherent in its nature's operation. So in his work Against Fate, which was directly against the Greek idea, the pagan Greek idea, Gregory of Nyssa says, "We may perceive the divine nature in every good thought and name manifested in our lives, such as light, truth, righteousness, wisdom, incorruptibility, and any other good we can comprehend. We recognize the divine nature and its attributes by all those things which are opposite to it. For example, death instead of life, deceit instead of truth, and every type of evil inimical to man." All this means is that reality is what the modern man believes is not real. Reality is wisdom, logos, while appearance is generated by it. Now, if human beings were sinless, wisdom would come first. That would be the first thing perceived. Qualities would serve as a decorative outer coating, so to speak. That's how law can actually be beautiful. It's the essence of the Platonic system in both the Statesman and the Symposium. But in simple terms, objects taken in isolation make no sense. Systems and the system of systems, which is wisdom, alone is the object of human knowledge. This is as far as the human mind can penetrate into the divine essence. Individual objects and the anomalous mind can only go as far as to produce natural reason and logic. The human will, reason, logic itself, themselves, and the body are productions of the earth and its natural processes. They can produce nothing but expressions of themselves. To claim that matter is all there is can only be an example of circular reasoning. If the earth produces human beings and their logic, then implied there is the idea that earthly things alone can be understood. It doesn't imply materialism, but it's both the result of both passion, intellectual laziness, and a corporate conformity you found in modern thinking. As Gregory states regularly, the human mind is not satisfied with the acquisition of the world and its earthly products. It desires more. This desire strongly implies the existence of a spiritual world that alone can make sense out of the free will. Logos, as you saw in the Stoics, can be seen in nature, however, very dimly. Man is possessed of spirit that is freedom, can produce Christ in the sense that Christ was capable of taking human flesh under the mask of a singular person. I should say humanity can produce. Say that the human nature, human form, can under the proper conditions produce a theotokos that can contain, so to speak, the presence of the divine fire. When considered rightly, the earth finds its proper place as a domain of the spirit. The individual, while important, also finds its place as secondary to the forms, the whole, the communities of the natural world. The final end is the total destruction of dualism. Matter becomes spiritualized while spirit takes on redeemed matter. Wisdom becomes the primary quality in matter, rather than a secondary quality, as is seen by us, by fallen man, dictated to only by earthly material desires. Reflecting on these desires, however, can't come from matter, since matter can only recognize itself. Now, some of you may note here that there is a lot of Vladimir Soloviev in this, and that's not an accident. Soloviev is one of these people who, at least in his metaphysics, if nothing else, made sense to me out of not just Logos doctrine and some of the church fathers, but even Hegel, who he was massively influenced by. But matter is capable of creating individuals. Like the Scholastics later, St. Gregory holds that matter is known primarily as a principle of individuation. But that's the same thing as appearing. Spirit can be created by matter, as the occultists of the Renaissance tried to claim, but the reverse is true. It can't be created by matter. Matter is created by spirit for its own purposes. The ideal becomes real under the form of matter as a family becomes one in form of a household. Thinking of the family as a singular unit is not the result of material processes. It's the result of wisdom inherent in matter that creates law where there is chaos. Law must come first, matter second. The reverse simply doesn't make any logical sense. Now, St. Gregory sets up his ontological poetry so the final purpose of his writings can be made manifest, to grasp, in a sense, the ascent of the human mind from the nominalist individual to the Platonic form, given its true shape through the incarnation. So, nominalism produces the dispersal of thoughts into eventual chaos and schizophrenia. Form is more real than matter, but it's largely inaccessible except by the truly gifted, such as people like Plato, the prophets, Marcus Aurelius, and the church fathers, of course. Grace, the presence of the spirit, which is one and the same thing, is required both to lift the mind to heaven as well as recognize the forms as truly real. In fact, grace is even necessary to implant the desire to rise above the muck of individuals and materialism. It's easy to live in the determined void world of matter. When I say determined, I mean simple cause and effect without freedom. It's hard to rise above it or even realize that you can rise above it. But the empirical reality still holds. Men have done this. How and why is a matter for philosophy, of course, not science. Now, two conflicting things. You have two conflicting things about the human mind here. It's a schism. It's the result of the fall. First, that the mind at its most ideal seek pleasures in truth that are beyond the present material world of individuals arbitrarily classed under genre and species. The latter seem distant, and for the nominalist, really non-existent. The second is that the mind, though in some second-order sense, desire to see the forms, to go beyond the material individual, the human mind is habituated to, like an animal, live in the world of the passions, which is precisely the desire for the material individual things of the world to dominate them. This is the hoarding desire of fallen man, whereby things like governments and possessions and armies and bureaucracies and factories and other idols are collected in the frantic desire for security. But they can't give security. It's natural in the fallen sense for the human mind to accept nominalism as true. It derives from the passions, not reason. It's because individual things are amenable to ownership, control, and destruction. Only when the mind is freed from this commodity fetish can man soar beyond the individual to the form or the foundation of the individual, which is what the form is. Once the modern world made factory life and the control over nature its main reason for existence, nominalism became its official ideology, since that mentality cannot even conceive of a form which gives shape and purpose to the natural world. The modern mentality claims that nature has no purpose precisely so the elite can give it purpose. Modernity can be reduced to that single proposition. If nature contains, at its essence, wisdom, then man becomes secondary. Our purpose, then, is to discover and enjoy it, and nothing more. Nominalism, in assuming that nature has no purpose, then gives the elite its ideological justification to control it. This domination is the giving purpose to nature. In other words, claiming that nature has no end is to give the elite permission to create it and recreate nature as they see fit. That's the very nature of industrialization. So in St. Gregory's work, in The Mind's Ascent, his philosophical concern is to refute nominalism in the practical sense, that individual objects in space-time are illusions. They're phantasms created by man's passion to dominate and to hoard. Now, that can be taken too far, as I think Berdyaev does on occasion. With the scriptures, particularly the books of wisdom, or the wisdom books as a whole, dealing explicitly with logos present in the world, as well as the liturgical poetry and the readings, are essential but insufficient for the mind's ascent from unreality to reality. Unreality is the nominal world, the world of appearance. They're twofold accompaniment. So you have labels and then corresponding emotions. The world of nominal realities, these things, these individuals that we're told exist, is the false world of labels masquerading as reality. And the term masquerade is essential because it denotes the words and labels so dear to nominalism as mere masks, revealing far less than they hide. Modernity's error is to take the mask as the real. The entire modern philosophy of language is predicated on that error. In the church, too, the ascent is made in symbolic form. The nave of the church itself is the fallen world, the cave, the veil of tears, in and from which we struggle against the passions for the sake of achieving reality. The icon screen, of course, is not a barrier, but an entryway from appearances to reality via the icons. Finally, the altar area is divine darkness, symbolized in the Old Testament by the Holy of Holies. Therefore, the church is a manifestation of the forms of wisdom present in the world. It's the only actual scientific reality in the world for that very reason. Symbols are not unreal, they're entryways into what's actually real. Man's desire for possessions demand that the unreal be taken as real. The elite, factory owners, the scientific establishment then decide what reality is. But the forms aren't the end of it. They're the penultimate stop to the divine darkness. Forms are the expression of divinely purged, divinity purged of all nominal appearances. Forms are the entryway to God, not God himself. While the forms are externalized wisdom which Logos synthesizes wholly, the origin of the form is the divine darkness. God the Father. God the Father is not rational, he is beyond form, reason, and logic. He is the origin of the order within which human logic and language make sense. The structure of reality or wisdom implies the further creator. To avoid an infinite regress, God the Father, beyond all rational description, save what is revealed through wisdom, is the final origin of all order and the order of order. The presence that must exist to make that order of eternal formal reality make sense at all, or to exist at all. So from his great catechism, he says, "For although this last form of God's presence among us is not the same as that former presence, still his existence among us equally, both then and now, is evidence. How he rules and is in order to hold together that nature and being, then he was transfused into our nature in order that our nature might, by this transfusion of the divine, become itself divine, being rescued from death and put beyond the reach of tyranny of the adversary. For his return from death becomes to our mortal race the commencement of our return to a mortal life." So the common element is the vision of order in created things. As mankind degenerates, his reason is more and more effaced, and it becomes now a mere rationalization. Nominalism exists in part to remove any language that might be used to express any kind of universal truth in the world. Once that's taken as an axiom, then reason has no use except as a means to gain the object of the passion. But like everyone in the patristic era, there is no distinction between spiritual and emotional state on the one hand and our perception of the external world on the other. The external world, in other words, is perceived in part according to our internal state. But this central postulate of patristic philosophy must be rejected by modern academic philosophy because it would eliminate most professional philosophers from ever doing anything, philosophizing at all. The point is to stress that perception doesn't account for the outside world. It accounts as much for our internal state as anything else. But God the Father is distinct from matter in the sense that God is one. He's unity. Matter is not. Matter is dual. It's dual because of the very nature of creation itself. God, as it says, pours himself out into creation, as the slogan goes. The Logos is found in everything. But matter is dual because it's material, but contains a logos, its purpose or place in all creation. It is known not through itself, but only in relation to all around it. So metaphysics centers around the spiritual state of the knower. And St. Gregory calls philosophy a speculative asceticism. That can only be accomplished when the knower has been purified. But Plato recognized this too. At the same time, speculation can't be separated from daily practice. There's no specialized philosopher that are well paid for their efforts. Practice and daily life can never be separated from the daily fare of philosophy. There's not a specialized academic philosophical vocabulary that can be quickly dispensed with when getting back to the real world. Philosophy is about purification when considered in speculation, while asceticism is about the actual world of purification. Philosophy has only has its purpose in self-mastery, to grasp the inner self and its purpose in the world. But as St. Augustine would say, or at least would not be opposed to saying, we come to some indirect knowledge of God and his activity. The body, seen as flesh in motion, acts as if it is self-sufficient. It pretends that it's that material things are all it needs. Only when one goes inward can that emptiness be seen. It's the soul and the will that need completion. Our passions are the Platonic unlimited, while our ascetic endeavors are the limit that is placed upon them. The nominal world, the world that is arbitrarily divided into things, objects, or sensibles, and groups of them, is normal. It's mediocre. It's the common possession of the ignorant. Objects aren't real in that they've been set off from each other. It's an arbitrary setting off having more to do with custom than reality, but it forms the very basis of nominalist ontology. What counts as an object, the individual, is always changing. Ecosystems are considered as individual as a fern without it, or the fern within it, or any object within it, but it does no harm to the doctrine considered common sense by those who are saturated and drowning in the modern world. And the philosopher is the only free man because only he can grasp the fact that the objects of this world are not objects of knowledge. They're objects of desire, first and foremost. They're as unstable as the desire for them is. The sensibles of modernist ontology can take on reality only when they become an aspect of the regime, the recreation of matter in the interest of the oligarchy. Individuals are only individuals when they are manipulated for the sake of those with the power just to so manipulate. Anyway, I'm sorry for the background noise and all of this. I'm not in my office. I'm on the road. I have the feeling that you'll live, though. You could still understand me. The point is that individual objects aren't objects of knowledge. They're only objects of desire. And they're unstable, as desires are unstable. But individual things only take on reality when they become an aspect of the ruling class. The recreation of matter in the interest of the oligarchy. Individuals are only individuals when they're manipulated for the sake of those with power to so manipulate, as I've said many times in the past. But the very words that Christ used to describe his own relation to the Father are the groundwork of St. Gregory's view, or the realistic view. Unmistakably metaphysical, in as in, I am in the Father, are terms used to describe the Church and its own relationship. But members of the Trinity are in one another. Each contains the other two. The Trinity itself is the middle ground, the idea of reality in itself, to use Hegelian terms, but the Trinity is the middle ground between that what became Islamic Unitarianism and some ever-changing pagan polytheism. But metaphysics itself forbade Gregory and his peers from seeing God as a mere unit. He's a community. His very power assumes and implies that he's creative, since his very thought is itself God. Since it's internal to the omniscient workings of God, his thought has to be God by definition. So simple reflection forbids the Unitarian concept of God to make any sense. St. Gregory rejects the filioque because the Father is the principle of unity, the generator that generates his own thought and action, which by definition must be God too, rather than simple aspects of himself. So, the Father serves as a core of reality since he is the ground of being, the I am. Yahweh then acts, then moves and thinks. He creates logos and the spirit from these actions. They're part of God, they come from him, yet a thought cannot be incomplete, nor can his action. They have to be God. There's no essential distinction between the thought and the mind that generates it. There's a distinction in hypostasis, or manifestation, but to separate them is to fall into the eternal nominalist error. Effects are never sui generis, nor is their meaning. Individuals make no sense unless seen as hypostases, or standing under the broader idea in the system. So, but when you reject nominalism, the social consequences end up being the doctrine of royal and patriarchal life. And paganism has to be democratic and material. If you read Ovid and the stories of the gods show democratic equality and independence from one another, and Logos doesn't have a will of its own. Only natures have wills. It serves the hypostasis of thought through the Father and thus has to be God. But paganism from Babylonia to Rome is chaos. Each entity, pantheon, reflects the minds of who first wrote the poems and stories. Social life is anarchy, only occasionally forced into shape by the transitory nature of superior force. But for the church, force doesn't make any sense. The ground of the relations are ontological. Nominalism only knows force, since force is the only thing that brings sensibles under one roof. All roofs, so to speak, are artificial and transitory. In the modern world, force is all that exists. So to grasp someone like Isaac Newton, you have to grasp the error of nominalism in the first place. The Father is the ground of existence, the Alpha and Omega of all relationships. The Father on Earth is the King and Patriarch. He's the ground of all familial relationships. The nominalist metaphysics that is adopted through political revolution, the Father loses all purpose. Anarchy remains. But an anarchy that serves to invite the oligarchy to impose its own sense of hierarchy. One hierarchy is no better than another, and no moral distinctions can be made if meaning is not to be found among sensibles as such. The visible world exists solely through light. Its presence is another way of speaking of this light, the power and grace that holds the cosmos together as a singular thing. But mental freedom is derived from this understanding. But the study of Logos is known in part by the study of the complexity of the natural laws as they manifest themselves in everything from biochemistry to physics. Logos in himself, outside of the church and its revelation, is another matter, though. The fact that the world of matter is law-bound is something assumed by modern science, but the origins, purpose, and end of such law is beyond their abilities. So, idolatry comes from the attempt to make sense out of Logos as a mechanical entity. More dangerous problem is grasp, or there's a group of well-meaning amateurs, and some not so well-meaning, who try to work out their own psychological problems through disputation on these things. Trying to pin down the actions of Logos both answer a need in some people to appear intelligent, but it also causes theology to become toxic. The human mind encased in matter is going beyond what it's capable of doing in it on its own. To say those who try to peer into the divine darkness are those often without spiritual preparation. One of the most important assumptions or axioms of the modern idea is the view of ancient medieval science. Medieval science is derived directly from the science of Rome itself. It's based on the Greek. The assumption of the Enlightenment is historic. Science per se only existed in the modern world. The Middle Ages were a time of superstition. Natural laws were not known in this era. People died allegedly at 30 in the Middle Ages. Our longevity derives directly from the new sciences developed as a result of the Enlightenment. Those who criticize modern science, those who are criticizing from a writer's point of view, were smeared as obscurantists. But it's based on a series of myths anyway. It's a rewriting of history in a weak sense. It posits really ignorant, sick people liberated by the developing scientific method in Britain, the Netherlands, and France. This method was self-generating, desirous only of finding the truth in the midst of superstition. So truth, science, and reason are defined in modernity precisely as that which derives only from this method. It finds its end in the development of technology. The conclusion, though, that the Western world is far more rational today than it was 1,000 years ago, that it must be far happier and healthier than it was 1,000 years ago. But this approach bears very little resemblance to actual history. The main distinction between medieval and modern science is that the latter has its final purpose, the development of technological apparatus. Greek and Roman science generally did not have machines as their end. The question, therefore, becomes how to explain ancient science. The Enlightenment approach claims that there was no science at all in the ancient world, and hence no science in the medieval world. The latter is merely an outgrowth of Roman ideas. The reality that the ancients developed powerful empires, centralized bureaucracies, mathematics, geometry, aesthetics, and astronomical precision and sophistication. Ancient medical science had a population living at roughly 70 years. The claim that the ancient world was unscientific, that the cathedral of Reims was built by ignorant craftsmen is to engage in just intellectual dishonesty. The precision of the ancient pyramids is alone equal to the most sophisticated building equipment of the 21st century, but no one denies that ancient science was very different from its modern inheritors. The difference lies in its product. Empirical and logical methods of inquiry were well developed in Egypt, Athens, Rome, and medieval Ireland. The Renaissance didn't resurrect Greek and Roman learning, nor did the Enlightenment recreate the nature of science and reason. Natural science existed in its empirical modes in the Roman Empire, and the literature of Greece and Rome were the daily fare of medieval intellectuals. The concept of enlightenment is thus an occult concept. What was resurrected is not the empirical method of Roman poetry, but rather the ancient Babylonian occult science of alchemy. This makes the Greco-medieval scientific mind very different from its medieval, from its modern successor. Anyway, I'm going to wrap this up now. I'm only at 50 minutes, but I'm going to do part two of this next week when I'm in a better position and back in my office as normal. But this is the fundamentals of the book that's going to be eventually finished one day on the nature of nominalism and the nature of logos. E. Michael Jones's book is a far more practical and theological concern. Mine is more of a metaphysical concern, but it has to be done either way. And then next time we're going to get into the Kabbalah and Isaac Lurie and the rest of them, which I've dealt with before, but never in any great detail. Anyway, thank you for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.